This is Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
Stanford 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
This is
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture on the air and online.
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Bienvenidos.
Atenea Americana.
Welcome. Bienvenidos.
From Stanford to the world.
Today, I am putting on the air a conference that took place a few days ago at the Center for Latin American Studies at Stanford University. The lecturer was Peter Kornblom, who is director of the National Security Archives Chile Documentation Project and of the Cuba Documentation Project. He had just finished a new book about the lost opportunities during the last 50 years to enter a peaceful and more productive relationship between Cuba and United States of America. The book is called Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and it is filled with documentations, photographies, memos, and all kind of valuable documentation that has been unclassified lately. He is also the author and co-author of other publications like Bay of Pigs, The Classified, The Secret CIA Report on the Invasion of Cuba, and The Iran-Contra Scandal, The Declassified History. But also, he is the author of the award-winning book, The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier of atrocity and accountability. Stay with us to learn more about this interesting book.
Have been working on this project for many, many years. I've been working on Cuba policy and U.S.-Cuban relations for probably 25, almost 30 years now. And a lot of my work focused on the 1960s and the history of acrimony between the United States and Cuba. I was privileged to be able to work with the Cubans to set up two historic conferences, one on the 40th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion, where we took down members of the actual brigade that had invaded Cuba. We took down some of the CIA guys that had been in charge of that operation. We took down all of the surviving Kennedy administration officials, Richard Goodwin, Arthur Schlesinger, and others, to meet with their counterparts, including Fidel Castro, and discuss what had happened at the Bay of Pigs. A year and a half later, we did a 40th anniversary conference on the missile crisis, and we took the Soviet generals who had been in charge of the missiles. We took Robert McNamara, who was very much in charge of U.S. policy. We took the CIA guy who actually discovered the missiles and the photographic and intelligence. And we met with Fidel Castro and his team and had a big conference. We brought all the international press for the first time. The Cubans basically presented their own documents on the missile crisis as well, and put themselves as part of the three-country history of this extraordinary episode. And what I was trying to do, and I said this at every press conference we had, was use history to create history. We were using the history of antagonism, of hostility, to civilly discuss the past, to bring what Wayne Smith, the kind of dean of Cuba work in Washington, called the closest of enemies together to talk about their acrimonious past in a civil way and see if, just by talking about it, that would be one way to move U.S.-Cuban relations forward. Because when we think of U.S.-Cuban relations, we think of these kinds of issues. We think of Kissinger ordering up attack plans on Cuba. When Fidel Castro sent his troops into Angola in late 1975 and the spring of 1976, we think of the very colorful but sinister and dark history of CIA assassination efforts against Fidel Castro, the exploding seashells, the toxic cigars, the sniper rifles, the poison pens. We think of Operation Mongoose and all that kind of odd-sounding code name for a complex set of covert operations of regime change towards Cuba. We think of the trade embargo, which is still in place till this very day. We think of exile terrorism, those hardline Cuban exiles who decided that violence was the way to overthrow the Castro regime or to block any process in positive relations between the United States and Cuba. We think of two countries that really have a very, very difficult past and who actually haven't spent much time talking together. And the fact is that it turns out that these two countries have spent a significant amount of time talking together. And that this history is becoming far more relevant to this day and age, alongside the conventional narrative that we all think about when we look back on U.S.-Cuban relations. In addition to what Henry Kissinger called the perpetual antagonism in U.S.-Cuban relations, there has been a fairly steady effort. It's an intermediate effort, but it's gone on from the Eisenhower days all the way through to this very day, where I dare say there is secret talks going on between the United States and Cuba to try and move the political football forward. And this has been a really interesting history. We set about trying to put this history under one cover, knowing that it would create a foundation, a historical precedence and foundation for whatever movement this president might feel compelled to make. It would give him at least the cover of history for the entire American public to know that it wasn't a heretical idea to negotiate with the Cubans, that it wasn't a heresy to actually try and normalize relations with Cuba, because president after president had done it before him. Every president since Eisenhower has seen some reason to talk to the Cubans, and several presidents, most notably Kennedy, Gerald Ford, mostly represented by Henry Kissinger, Jimmy Carter, and to a somewhat lesser extent, Bill Clinton, actually tried to start to change fundamentally the framework of U.S.-Cuban relations. And that is a history that now is applicable for what the Obama White House is thinking about doing.
Today in Atenea Americana, we are listening to a presentation of the book Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiation Between Washington and Havana. It is presented by its author, Peter Cornlaw, who is director of the National Security Archives, Chile Documentation Projects, and Cuba Documentation Project. Among the reviews of the book, we have what President Carter say about it. Leo Grande and Cornblow have analyzed truthfully the history of dialogue between two countries locked in a contradictory relationship for five decades, with each side skeptical that the other truly wanted improved relations. With continual change in Washington and continuity in Cuban leadership, the authors draw an important lesson from the efforts of every administration since Eisenhower to negotiate with Cuba. Stay with us to listen a little bit more about this book.
Tiene un violín que no ama, pero siente que el violín lo llama por las noches como arrepentido.
It's been an interesting set of events. We can look at John Kennedy and the way he did it. Here's the president that's mostly known for what? Greenlighting the invasion at the Bay of Pigs, authorizing Operation Mongoose in its aftermath. So upset he and his brother were at losing at the Bay of Pigs, wanting revenge against Castro for dealing them a defeat, instituting the trade embargo, which exists today. That is basically what Kennedy is known for. But, in truth, after the missile crisis, John F. Kennedy started to rethink seriously the dangers of the Cold War. He came to the conclusion that it was a bad idea to have really hostile relations with the Soviet Union. He made a very famous speech in June of 1963 on the steps of American University about how to go forward with the Cold War, coexist with the Soviet Union. But he also decided that having Cuba be kind of a focal point in the Cold War between the superpowers, given how disastrously close we came to actually firing at one another during the missile crisis, that it might be a good idea to explore, as McGeorge Bundy said to me when I first interviewed him in 1996, what was possible. What was possible with Castro? What you see when you look at the secret documentation of the Kennedy administration is that starting in April of 1963, the Kennedy White House and the National Security Council start to put on the agenda of all the option papers what was termed the sweet approach, as opposed to the overt and covert nastiness of U.S. policy towards Cuba, the possibility of using the sweet approach to entice Castro over to us. But so sensitive was this issue, so opposed was the CIA, for example, that Kennedy had to do this through secret intermediaries, and he used three intermediaries. This guy, James Donovan, was a New York lawyer, and he was used to negotiate the release of all the Bay of Pigs prisoners. And then in the aftermath of that successful negotiation, which was the first serious negotiation with Fidel Castro, he was sent back in the spring of 1963 to negotiate the release of 27 Americans who were held in Cuban jails for counter-revolutionary activities, among them a team of three CIA technicians from the CIA's Technical Services Division who were caught red-handed planting bugs in the ceiling of a building in downtown Havana and thrown into Castro's jails. And he managed to go back and forth to Cuba, shuttle diplomacy in the spring of 1963, and negotiated a prisoner exchange. It's fascinating, and I'm telling you this, I have just come from the archives at the Hoover Institute here. And all of James Donovan's papers are there. And they just make for fascinating reading. But all the papers on his negotiations to free the Bay of Pigs prisoners, his diaries, his chronologies, his correspondence, everything but actually the secret U.S. documents, many of you, which you can see quoted in this book. And he negotiated the first substantive prisoner exchange with Cuba. He got from Castro 27 U.S. citizens, and in return, the United States released four Cubans who were in U.S. jails in New York. One of them was a Castro sympathizer who had gotten involved in a brawl fight with anti-Castro exiles in New York City, pulled out a gun. In those days, you know, there were no gun control laws and people carried guns. He pulled out a pistol during this fight and it went off and the bullet went across the street into a restaurant and killed a 9-year-old girl. And he was convicted of second-degree homicide and put in jail for, I don't know, 20 years in upstate New York. And Kennedy ordered Nelson Rockefeller to release him. And he also then ordered Kennedy offer the release of three other Cubans who were tied to Cuba's UN mission in New York City, who had been arrested on charges of conspiring to commit sabotage in New York. This was during the missile crisis era. It's not clear what they were really doing. But those four Cubans were immediately released. They were sent to Cuba, and the same day, these 27 Americans were let go, 21 of which returned to the United States with James Donovan. He was the first key intermediary and to really set the stage for what was called at the time meta-diplomacy, kind of a respectful position of dealing with Castro. And Castro was actually very, very interested in what this foundation of these prisoner releases could do for the future of U.S.-Cuban relations. This woman, the second intermediary, an ABC News correspondent named Lisa Howard. Anybody ever heard of her before, besides Arturo? A phenomenally interesting story. We're working on a movie about her. We already made a documentary film about her, which is a little bit hard to find, but really super interesting. The first woman to be hired as a correspondent for ABC News. The first woman to ever have her own news show on television. It was called News with a Woman's Touch, sponsored by Purex. 1962-63. She was known as the first Barbara Walters, because she would go around trying to get interviews with these, mostly men, but she, but women as well, who were famous around the world. Eleanor Roosevelt, Shah of Iran, Barry Goldwater, Nikita Khrushchev, and she set her sights on interviewing Fidel Castro. And she actually came down just as Donovan was leaving in April of 1963, and Castro wouldn't see her, and she went to Donovan and she said, "Won't you please broker an introduction for me?" And Donovan said, "Okay." And he went to Castro and he said, and excuse the sexist language that he used, but he said, "There's a beautiful blonde dish of a reporter that wants to meet you. I recommend you give her some time." And Castro spent a whole night at the Hotel Riviera being interviewed by her just before he left for the Soviet Union for a month, to kind of patch up his relationship with Nikita Khrushchev in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And she aired the first special on ABC News on Castro, an hour-long program, in May of 1963, and then she returned in 1964. And we'll get back to her in a second. She came back from Cuba completely convinced that U.S.-Cuban relations could be much closer, and offering her services as a secret intermediary to bring the two countries together. She turned her house on Central Park East into a communication center where U.S. officials would come in the middle of the night and place phone calls to Fidel Castro's office in an effort to communicate directly. She met repeatedly with the National Security Council of both Kennedy and Johnson, passing messages back and forth from Castro to the presidents of the United States. And right here, another reporter as an intermediary, Jean Daniel. This is the story that most people know because Jean Daniel was with Fidel Castro at the moment John Kennedy was killed in Dallas. And Jean Daniel, a French journalist, was carrying a message from Kennedy to Castro about the possibilities for better relations. And Castro was very positive hearing this message. They were actually in Veradero Beach at a safe house. The fishermen from the beach had just brought in a big fish for lunch that they just pulled out of the ocean for these two guys to eat. They're talking about Kennedy's message. Fidel's exclaiming that Kennedy could become the most important leader of the Western world, realizing that the socialist camp and the capitalist camps could live in harmony together somehow. And the news comes in that Kennedy has been killed. And Castro says two things. The first thing he says is they're going to say we did it, which is true. That's the first thing that was first rumor that circulated in the United States. And then he said to Jean Daniel, "There goes your mission of peace." And Jean Daniel agreed. There was no Kennedy to take Castro's response back to. There could be no, obviously, mission. So that is how kind of the secret diplomacy got started through intermediaries, because it was too politically sensitive to talk directly between the two countries. Even today, it seems too politically sensitive to just have an open dialogue on this issue of better relations between the two countries, but we'll get to that in just a second. I told you that one of the fascinating things about this history is to learn that every president since Eisenhower, except for George W. Bush, has seen fit to significantly talk to Cuba about one thing or another. But there was another part of this history that we found in doing the book that was really striking, and that is that Fidel Castro has reached out to every president, even those hardline presidents, again and again. And this is a document which is well known to anybody who studies Cuba. It's a document that's dated only 4 months or so after the invasion at the Bay of Pigs. And 4 months later, Castro is basically reaching out to the Kennedy administration through Che Guevara and saying, we would like to have a modus vivendi with you. This is a famous memo that Richard Goodwin, Kennedy's top aide on Latin America, writes to the president after his meeting, somewhat surprising and impromptu meeting, in Montevideo, Uruguay, with Che Guevara. They're both at an Alliance for Progress meeting. Guevara practices what in the book we call first act of cigar diplomacy. He grabs this Argentine diplomat and sends him, Horacio Larreta, and sends him across the room to Goodwin. And Larreta comes across the room and he says, that guy over there, see him, that Cuban over there, he has a dare for you. He's daring you to smoke a Cuban cigar. And Richard Goodwin says, I'd smoke one if I had one, but you know they're very difficult to find in the United States now. And that night, in his hotel room, there was this beautiful mahogany box filled with cigars and a handwritten note from Che Guevara, basically saying, to talk to the enemy is hard. I extend my hand. I can only extend my hand. The cigars were obviously not really for Goodwin. They were for President Kennedy. And Goodwin takes them back to President Kennedy. And he takes them into the Oval Office along with this extraordinary memo. And Kennedy, who loved Cuban cigars, opens the box, pulls out the cigar, snips off the end, lights it up, takes a couple of puffs, and looks at Goodwin and says, maybe you should take the first puff. Kennedy, of course, knew in the back of his mind that cigars could be assassination devices. So he tries to hand it off to Goodwin, and Goodwin says to him, it's too late now, Mr. President. And that's the way the initial effort at cigar diplomacy took.
This is Atenea Americana, and I am your host, Isabel Jubes. You may find this and all my shows at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. This is a bilingual cultural show, bringing you a window to the Latin and Hispanic universe. Every week, for 2 hours, one in English and one in Spanish, from Stanford to the world. You can also be part of this, leaving me your comments, sharing your thoughts, and even more at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. I invite you to be part of this. And today, in Atenea Americana, we're listening to a presentation of the book Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiation Between Washington and Havana.
As an example of Cuba and Castro reaching out, even in the wake of the most flagrant act of U.S. aggression, this document is extraordinary. Che Guevara says to Goodwin at this meeting, thank you for the Bay of Pigs. It transformed us from an aggrieved little country into an equal and allowed us to consolidate the revolution. And Goodwin's response was, well, why don't you invade Guantanamo then? And give us a reason to attack you. And Guevara said, no, I don't think we'll do that. So that's the first example. But there are endless other examples, and I just want to run through and show them. When Kennedy is killed, Castro decides he's going to reach out to Lyndon Johnson and basically with a message saying, listen, we were talking to Kennedy. Do you want to continue those talks? And he sends this oral message with Liza Howard back in February of 1964, which makes this point. We were talking to the previous administration. We're willing to talk to you also. We understand that it's a political year in the United States, 1964. You're going to be running against some right-wing Republican for president. And if you want to verbally and even in reality, attack us, as long as you let us know it's just for political reasons to make you look good in the eyes of the electorate, we'll understand. We would like to continue these talks. And then the final point, a very important one, please don't consider our willingness to engage in these talks as a sign of weakness. That would be a huge mistake on your part. So Castro reaches out to Lyndon Johnson at the very beginning of his tenure as president. The same thing happens with Richard Nixon, and this is a very startling set of events. Nixon, who, as you can see from the picture on the front of the book, has actually met Castro when he's vice president, and Castro comes to Washington April of 1959. Nixon is an inveterate hater of Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro in particular. A big advocate for the Bay of Pigs and for the exile violence against Cuba. And yet, only 11 days after Nixon is inaugurated, Castro calls in the Swiss ambassador, who is an intermediary between the United States and Cuba, and runs through a whole list of issues that he would like to work out with the United States, including better overall relations and the possibility of Cuba withdrawing from supporting leftist movements in Latin America, one of the key demands that the United States has for changing policy. See, starting to talk about it right there at the bottom of the page. This document is dated in March. Castro meets with the Swiss ambassador in January, or very early February, and then the Swiss send their ambassador to Washington, and he meets with the State Department to convey Castro's message. All this effort, starting with Nixon, doesn't pan out to be a significant change in relations, but Henry Kissinger does, in fact, pick up the idea at the end of the Nixon era, the summer of 1974, and he initiates on his own reaching out to Castro and starting the first serious talks between the United States and Cuba. I show you these documents because they're absolutely critical to what is possible today. You have an aide memoir written right here, which sets the tone. This was drafted three different times. Kissinger kept redrafting it to make it more straightforward. His advice to his aides was, deal with Castro as a straight guy, as a big guy, not like a shyster. You should deal with Castro as a big guy, not as a shyster. Let's not try and con him. Tell him we are ready to move in a new direction. Tell him we need reciprocity from Cubans. But he lays out a message to the Cubans. This was used in the very first secret meeting, January of 1975, between Castro's people and Kissinger's people. He lays out the tone of what is possible, and this is the same tone that one could use, that Obama could use today. We have different systems. That doesn't mean that we can't see eye to eye on a wide variety of things and live basically in peace. And you've got the very first page of this three-hour meeting at the Pierre Hotel in New York City a number of months later, in which, for the first time, the United States and Cuba sit down and try and seriously negotiate better relations. Now, Jimmy Carter picked up where Kissinger left off. He was the very first president to order his own bureaucracy to normalize relations with Cuba. He ordered all of these agencies, the Justice Department, the Commerce Department, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, all to begin a process, a careful step-by-step set of talks with the Cubans. Secret meetings were held at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. They were held in a hotel in Cuernavaca. They were held in Atlanta. They were held at a wonderful French restaurant in Manhattan. There were meetings on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial between Castro's emissaries and Carter's representatives. An extraordinary set of talks. The sticking point for the United States was that Cuba still had troops in Africa. And basically, their precondition was that Cuba get out of Africa and Carter would then go forward in normalizing relations. And Fidel Castro kind of had a really interesting response. Eventually, there were a whole series of secret meetings, and then a team, a two-man team from the Carter White House, went to Havana and met face-to-face with Castro. And Castro's position was, look, I don't tell you where to put your troops, but I don't understand why you think you have the right to tell me where I put my troops. So I may be naive, but I have always thought that it's not legitimate for the United States to have one set of rules for itself and another set of rules for all other countries. We are willing to have better and normal relations with you, but we're not willing to be told how to conduct our foreign policy. And in the end, as you know, Carter lost the election in 1980 to Ronald Reagan, helped in part by the deterioration of U.S.-Cuban relations and the Mariel Exodus, the immigration crisis, with all the little boats going from the port of Mariel with Fidel's permission to the United States. There's a whole history of secret diplomacy right then in which Carter sends his emissaries to talk to Fidel, basically say, look, you're helping Ronald Reagan with this exodus. You're creating problems in Florida. You're making the president look weak. He already has the crisis. with the hostages in Iran. If you want to deal with Ronald Reagan, you're doing this. But if you want to deal with us, stop the Mariel boat lift, and we will commit to talking about broader, better relations in the second term. Of course, there was no second term. And one of the most poignant things that Jimmy Carter said to us when we interviewed him for this book was that, in retrospect, he wished he had overruled Zbigniew Brzezinski and just moved forward in his first term and implemented this very presidential directive to normalize relations with Cuba. I should just say, so you know, that even Ronald Reagan got a set of gestures from Fidel Castro that they wanted better relations, that they wanted a breakthrough on U.S.-Cuban relations. As you can see from this document, National Security Council, it's reported that Havana has repeatedly attempted to pass messages and signals for better relations and completely rebuffed and rejected by Alexander Haig and others. And this is an action memo, a decision memo, asking for approval to basically reject the Cubans, and you can see the approval is accepted. Very, very sensitive history. And yet it continues. It continues to this day. So sensitive about talking to Cuba that a cast of characters was used from Carter onward that is worth thinking about. In the book, there's a whole discussion of how Gabriel Garcia Marquez became a messenger between Fidel Castro and Bill Clinton. He carried messages to end the Balsero crisis, August of 1994. He carried messages in 1997 and met with President Clinton and Sandy Berger at the White House about the attacks on Cuba that were being carried out by exiles, the attacks on the hotels and discotheques that were going on in Havana at that time. And he returned a year later in 1998 with Castro's intelligence on a plot to blow up a plane, and asking that, in fact, there be FBI collaboration with Cuba. And the Clinton administration sent a team of FBI officials to Havana to talk to the Cubans. It was kind of the high point of counterterrorism collaboration. It was then undermined by the FBI's decision to arrest Cuban spy network that was in the United States, the so-called WASP network, the Red de Avispas.
And today, in Atenea Americana, we are listening to a presentation of the book Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiation Between Washington and Havana. It is presented by its author, Peter Cornwell, who is director of the National Security Archives, Chile Documentation Projects, and Cuba Documentation Project. I travel far and I travel wide. I thought I had lots of things I had. I'm on a mission beyond a superstition, and I don't know better. I know I should go on, go on, go on, go on, don't stop.
There was originally, I believe, 14 spies. 10 of them, five of them managed to get back to Cuba and escape the FBI dragnet. Four of them were arrested and turned state witness and kind of ratted out their intelligence service and were given new identities and sent off to live in the United States. And five of them, so-called Cuban Five, which many of you have heard about, did not testify, refused to talk about their intelligence work, and were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage in the United States. And there are three of them still in prison more than 16 years later, and this is the discussion you're seeing about a prisoner swap and a prisoner issue, trading them, three spies, for Alan Gross, the USAID contractor who's about to pass his fifth year as a prisoner in Cuba for smuggling satellite communications equipment onto the island. You have one of the most colorful and unknown secret emissaries, the chairman of Coca-Cola, J. Paul Austin, bringing very detailed messages from Jimmy Carter down to Fidel Castro. You have the daughter of David Rockefeller, Peggy Dulaney, carrying messages from Castro to Secretary Shultz during the Reagan administration. Bill Richardson, U.S. Congressman, Ambassador to the United Nations, Governor of New Mexico, involved in at least five different trips to Cuba carrying messages, most recent one trying to get Alan Gross out. And then the most surprising secret interlocutor between Cuba and the United States was the former president of the United States, Jimmy Carter himself, who was enlisted in August of 1994 by the Cubans to be the intermediary with Bill Clinton and end the Balsero crisis. So sensitive is this issue of talking directly to the Cubans that even though the Cubans have repeatedly said, let's have direct talks about better relations, about a spy swap, the Obama administration has not taken them up on it. Instead, to this day, secret intermediaries continue to be used to discuss this issue. But the history is still important. It creates a foundation for what could be. It creates a historical record of what has worked in negotiating with the Cubans in the past. And we are right now trying to use the precedents of the spy, of the prisoner exchanges that have taken place over the years and how they've been negotiated, how they've worked, to create an atmosphere in which Obama could go forward and rationalize a spy, a prisoner exchange now, these three Cuban spies for Alan Gross. This picture and the pictures that were taken literally milliseconds later of the two leaders shaking hands clearly gives you a visual image of what could be between these two countries. And it was at the Mandela Memorial when Obama himself, just seconds after shaking Raul Castro's hand, stood up and gave a speech about how the world can be defined not by our differences, but by our common hopes. And there's no doubt when one looks at the history of U.S.-Cuban relations, the history of Cuba, the history of the United States, and what it wants, that there are common hopes. Barack Obama, some of you may remember, when he was running for president for the first time, and he was still in the primaries, it wasn't clear whether it was going to be him or Hillary Clinton that got the Democratic nomination in 2008, said during a televised CNN debate with Hillary Clinton that he would sit down and talk to Raul Castro. And now he has the opportunity. Why this history is so relevant at this very moment is where I want to leave us. It's relevant because for the very first time there's going to be a summit of the Americas in which Cuba is invited. And the invitations are going to go out relatively soon. They were going to go out earlier, and the rumor has it that the Obama White House asked the Panamanians that are hosting the summit to delay the invitation so that the U.S. position ongoing didn't become part of the political debate before the midterm elections. The midterm elections are over. The Democrats certainly weren't helped one way or the other with the fact that the Cuba issue wasn't discussed. But now we have a situation where in the coming weeks, these invitations are going to arrive to Raul Castro, to Barack Obama, to all the other presidents of Latin America. Latin America is responsible for this. It said to the United States, we will not attend the next summit of the Americas unless Cuba is invited. The Latin Americans finally reached this point with this 55-year effort by the United States, by Washington, to isolate Cuba. And now, of course, we are isolating only ourselves. So Barack Obama will have this opportunity. Will he go to the summit? Or will he decide himself not to go because Raul Castro is going to be there? Will he go to the summit and create a scene to protest the fact that one government, Cuba, is not a democracy, but is at the summit? Will he take dissidents, for example, with him, put them on the agenda of the summit, and attempt to use the summit to embarrass the Cubans and push the issue of democracy? Or will he go to the summit and use it as the golden diplomatic opportunity that he has and that he said when he was a candidate he wanted to use to sit down with Raul Castro and agree to a framework for a new policy relationship between these two countries. We can talk about the whole issue of what normal relations would bring in terms of the U.S. ability to more positively influence Cuba in the future. Obama himself has said that engagement really is the best way to promote democracy in Cuba. Historically, you had 55 years of an effort to promote democracy by isolating Cuba, pressuring Cuba, twisting the economic pressures on Cuba, none of that has worked. And so Obama himself, being a pragmatist, I think would like to try something new. Let me just leave you with an anecdote that goes all the way back to this guy whose papers are here at the Hoover's, James Donovan. He went back and forth to Cuba in the spring of 1963 to negotiate the release of these Americans and get these three CIA guys. The CIA really wanted their guys back, just like the Cubans want their spies back from the United States. And that swap did take place. And as it was coming to fruition, Fidel Castro said to him, "Mr. Donovan, is it possible that now that we have pleaded this prisoner exchange, food stuffs and medicine for the Bay of Pigs prisoners, and now American citizens and my prisons for these Cubans and your jails, is it possible that now that we've gotten through this negotiation, this could be a basis for moving forward in U.S.-Cuban relations?" Castro, the first week of April 1963, said for the very first time, he said, "What would it take for the United States and Cuba to kind of bridge the gap of this dark history of the Bay of Pigs and missile crisis and have better relations?" And Donovan said to him, "Mr. Castro, do you know how porcupines make love?" And Castro had to turn to his interpreter and ask, "Puercoespinos haciendo el amor? ¿Qué es eso?" Castro said, "No, I do not know how they make love." And Donovan said, "Very carefully. And that is how you and the United States will go about improving relations." That conversation took place in 1963, 51 years ago, and very carefully has been in some ways kind of the operative modus operandi, if you will, of these stalled and hesitant and at many times tentative efforts over the years to talk, to negotiate issues between us and arrive at some new situation between our countries. Now is not the time for very cautiously anymore. Obama has 2 years left in his presidency. He has a golden opportunity between today and April for the summit of the Americas to lay the groundwork for better relations and then go to the summit and actually consummate, if you will, a new relationship, drawing on the porcupine metaphor. That is the situation today, and I'm so happy that we have this history here that we can consult as we not only watch this dynamic play out in the coming months, but hopefully all of us participate in it. So you're participating by coming, being part of this talk, and now I want to hear what you think about it yourself. So thank you for coming.
This was Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Stanford, 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe. This is
Radio Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture, on the air and online.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Vuelve pronto.
Atenea Americana.
From Stanford to the world.
Remember to come back soon.
Ciao.
See you later.